Chapter 24. And what's your answer, if you know? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. He made none at the minute, but turned away slowly to the door. There, with his hand on the threshold, he stopped to ask, almost under his breath. Then you really think my stuff's no good? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I was tired and exasperated, and I laughed. I don't defend my laugh, it was in wretched taste. But I must plead in extenuation, that the boy was a fool, and that I'd done my best for him, I really had. He went out of the room, shutting the door quietly after him. That afternoon I left for Frascati, where I'd promised to spend the Sunday with some friends. I was glad to escape from Gilbert, and by the same token, as I learned that night, I had also escaped from the eyes. I dropped into the same lethargic sleep that had come to me before when their visitation ceased, and when I woke the next morning, in my peaceful painted room above the ilexes, I felt the utter weariness and deep relief that always followed on that repairing slumber. I put in two blessed nights at Frascati, and when I got back to my rooms in Rome I found that Gilbert had gone. Oh, nothing tragic had happened, the episode never rose to that. He'd simply packed his manuscripts and left for America for his family and the Wall Street desk. He left a decent little note to tell me of his decision, and behaved altogether, in the circumstances, as little like a fool as it's possible for a fool to behave. IV. Culwin paused again, and again Frenham sat motionless, the dusky contour of his young head reflected in the mirror at his back. And what became of Noyes afterward? I finally asked, still disquieted by a sense of incompleteness, by the need of some connecting thread between the parallel lines of the tale. Culwin twitched his shoulders. Oh, nothing became of him, because he became nothing. There could be no question of becoming about it. He vegetated in an office, I believe, and finally got a clerkship in a consulate, and married drearily in China. I saw him once in Hong Kong, years afterward. He was fat and hadn't shaved. I was told he drank. He didn't recognize me. And the eyes? I asked, after another pause which Frenham's continued silence made oppressive. Culwin, stroking his chin, blinked at me meditatively through the shadows. I never saw them after my last talk with Gilbert. Put two and two together if you can. For my part, I haven't found the link. He rose stiffly, his hands in his pockets, and walked over to the table on which reviving drinks had been set out. You must be parched after this dry tale. Here, help yourself, my dear fellow. Here, Phil, he turned back to the hearth. Frenham still sat in his low chair, making no response to his host's hospitable summons. But as Culwin advanced toward him, their eyes met in a long look, after which, to my intense surprise, the young man, turning suddenly in his seat, flung his arms across the table and dropped his face upon them. Culwin, at the unexpected gesture, stopped short, a flush on his face. Phil, what the deuce? Why, have the eyes scared you? My dear boy, my dear fellow, I never had such a tribute to my literary ability, never. He broke into a chuckle at the thought, and halted on the hearth rug, his hands still in his pockets, gazing down in honest perplexity at the youth's bowed head. Then, as Frenham still made no answer, he moved a step or two nearer. Cheer up, my dear Phil. It's years since I've seen them. Apparently I've done nothing lately bad enough to call them out of chaos. Unless my present evocation of them has made you see them, which would be their worst stroke yet. His bantering appeal quivered off into an uneasy laugh, and he moved still nearer, bending over Frenham, and laying his gouty hands on the lad's shoulders. Phil, my dear boy, really what's the matter? Why don't you answer? Have you seen the eyes? Frenham's face was still pressed against his arms, and from where I stood behind Culwin I saw the latter, as if under the rebuff of this unaccountable attitude, draw back slowly from his friend. As he did so, the light of the lamp on the table fell full on his perplexed, congested face, and I caught its sudden reflection in the mirror behind Frenham's head. Culwin saw the reflection also. He paused, his face level with the mirror, as if scarcely recognizing the countenance in it as his own. But as he looked, his expression gradually changed, and for an appreciable space of time he and the image in the glass confronted each other with a glare of slowly gathering hate. Then Culwin let go of Frenham's shoulders, and drew back a step, covering his eyes with his hands. Frenham, his face still hidden, did not stir. The blonde beast, It had been almost too easy. That was young Milner's first feeling, as he stood again on the Spence doorstep, the great moment of his interview behind him, and Fifth Avenue rolling its grimy pactolus at his feet. Halting there in the winter light, with the clang of the ponderous vestibule doors in his ears, and his eyes carried down the perspective of the packed interminable thoroughfare, he even dared to remember Rastignac's apostrophe to Paris, and to hazard recklessly under his small fair mustache colon who knows? He, Hugh Milner, at any rate, knew a good deal already. A good deal more than he had imagined it possible to learn in half an hour's talk with a man like Orlando G. Spence, and the loud rumoring city spread out there before him seemed to grin like an accomplice who knew the rest. A gust of wind, whirling down from the dizzy height of the building on the next corner, drove sharply through his overcoat, and compelled him to clutch at his hat. It was a bitter January day, a day of fierce light and air, when the sunshine cut like icicles, and the wind sucked one in two black gulfs at the street corners. But Milner's complacency was like a warm lining to his shabby coat, and heaving steadied his hat he continued to stand on the Spence threshold, lost in the vision revealed to him from the Pisgah of its marble steps. Yes, it was wonderful what the vision showed him. In his absorption he might have frozen fast to the doorstep, if the adamantine portals behind him had not suddenly opened to let out a slim fur-coated figure, the figure, as he perceived, of the youth whom he had caught in the act of withdrawal as he entered Mr. Spence's study, and whom the latter, with a wave of his affable hand, had detained to introduce as Y. Son Draper. It was characteristic of the odd friendliness of the whole scene, that the great man should have thought it worth, while to call back and name his heir to a mere humble applicant like Milner, and that the heir should shed on him, from a pale high-browed face, a smile of such deprecating kindness. It was characteristic, equally, of Milner, that he should at once mark the narrowness of the shoulders sustaining this ingenuous head, a narrowness, as he now observed, imperfectly concealed by the white fur collar of young Spence's expensive and badly cut coat. But the face took on, as the youth smiled his surprise at their second meeting, a look of almost plaintive goodwill. The kind of look that Milner scorned, and yet could never quite resist. "Mr. Milner, are you awaiting?" the lad asked, with an intention of serviceableness that was like a finer echo of his father's resounding cordiality. "For my motor?" "No," Milner jested in his frank, free voice. "The fact is, I was just standing here lost in the contemplation of my luck, and as his companion's pale blue eyes seemed to shape a question, my extraordinary luck," he explained, "common having been engaged as your father's secretary." "Oh," the other rejoined, with a faint color in his sallow cheek. "I'm so glad," he murmured colon, but I was sure he stopped, and the two looked kindly at each other. Milner averted his gaze first, almost fearful of its betraying the added sense of his own strength and dexterity which he drew from the contrast of the other's frailness. "Sure? How could anyone be sure? I don't believe in it yet." He laughed out in the irony of his triumph. The boy's words did not sound like a mere civility Milner felt in them an homage to his power. "Oh, yes. I was sure," young Draper repeated. "As sure as soon as I saw you, I mean." Milner tingled again with this tribute to his physical straightness and bloom. "Yes, he looked his part, hang it, he looked it. but his companion still lingered, a shy sociability in his eye. If you're walking, then, can I go along a little way? And he nodded southward down the shabby, gaudy avenue. That, again, was part of the high comedy of the hour, that Milner should descend the Spence steps at young Spence's side, and stroll down Fifth Avenue with him at the proudest moment of the afternoon. O.G. Spence's secretary walking abroad with O.G. Spence's heir. He had the scientific detachment to pull out his watch and furtively note the hour. Yes, it was exactly 40 minutes since he had rung the Spence doorbell and handed his card to a gelid footman, who, openly skeptical of his claim to be received, had left him unceremoniously planted on the cold tessellations of the vestibule. Someday, Miller grinned to himself, I think I'll take that footman as furnace man, or to do the boots. And he pictured his marble palace rising from the earth, to form the mausoleum of a footman's pride. Only 40 minutes ago. And now he had his opportunity fast. And he never meant to let it go. It was incredible what had happened in the interval. He had gone up the Spence steps an unknown young man, out of a job, and with no substantial hope of getting into one. A needy young man with a mother, and two limp sisters to be helped, and a lengthening figure of debt, that stood by his bed through the anxious nights. And he went down the steps with his present assured, and his future lit by the hues of the rainbow above the pot of gold. Certainly a fellow who made his way at that rate had it in him, and could afford to trust his star. Descending from this joyous flight he stooped his ear to the discourse of young Spence. My father'll work you rather hard, you know. But you look as if you wouldn't mind that. Milner pulled up his inches with the self-consciousness of the man who had none to waste. Oh, no, I shan't mind that. I don't mind any amount of work, if it leads to something. Just so, Draper Spence assented eagerly. Tee, that's what I feel. And you'll find that, whatever my father undertakes leads to such awfully fine things. Milner tightened his lips on a grin. He was thinking only of where the work would lead him, not in the least of where it might land the eminent Orlando G. Spence. But he looked at his companion sympathetically. You're a philanthropist like your father, I see. Oh, I don't know. They had paused at a crossing, and young Draper, with a dubious air, stood striking his agate-headed stick against the curbstone. I believe in a purpose, don't you? He asked, lifting his blue eyes suddenly to Milner's face. A purpose? I should rather say so. I believe in nothing else, cried Milner, feeling as if his were something he could grip in his hand and swing like a club. Young Spence seemed relieved. Why, yes, I tie up to that. There is a purpose. And so, after all, even if I don't agree with my father on minor points. He colored quickly, and looked again at Milner. I should like to talk to you about this someday. Milner smothered another smile. We'll have lots of talks, I hope. Oh, if you can spare the time, said Draper, almost humbly. Why, I shall be there on tap. For father, not me. Draper hesitated, with another self-confessing smile. If father thinks I talk too much, that I keep going in and out of things. He doesn't believe in analyzing. He thinks it's destructive. But it hasn't destroyed my ideals. He looked wistfully up and down the clanging street. And that's the main thing, isn't it? I mean, that one should have an ideal. He turned back almost gaily to Milner. I suspect you're a revolutionist too. Revolutionist? Rather. I belong to the Red Syndicate and the Black Hand. Milner joyfully assented. Young Draper chuckled at the enormity of the joke. F first rate. We'll have incendiary meetings. He pulled an elaborately armorial watch from his enfolding furs. I'm so sorry, but I must say goodbye. This is my street, he explained. Milner, with a faint twinge of envy, glanced across at the colonnaded marble edifice in the farther corner. Gee, going to the club? He said carelessly. His companion looked surprised. Oh, no. I never go there. It's too boring, and he brought out, after one of the pauses in which he seemed rather breathlessly, to measure the chances of his listener's indulgence, I'm just going over to a little Bible class I have in 10th Avenue. Milner, for a moment or two, stood watching the slim figure wind its way through the mass of vehicles to the opposite corner. Then he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.